Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined later today by my co-host Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. We have two great guests today. We will start shortly. Our first guest is Steve Emerson, the executive director of the Investigative Project on Terrorism. And in the second half of the show, Don Irvine will be interviewing Lee Edwards about his Victims of Communism memorial and other things that are relevant in the news today. So we are going to start off with Steve Emerson. Steve, are you there?
I am here. Good to be with you, Roger.
Great to have you. Steve, as I say, is the executive director of the Investigative Project on Terrorism, the IPT, a nonprofit research group he founded in 1995. It is recognized as the world's most comprehensive data center on radical Islamic terrorist groups. For more than a decade, the IPT has investigated the operations, funding, activities, and front groups of Islamic terrorist and extremist groups in the U.S. and around the world. It has become a principal source of critical evidence to a wide variety of government offices and law enforcement agencies, as well as the U.S. Congress and numerous public policy forums. Prior to the IPT, Steve worked on staff as an investigator for the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has worked for U.S. News and World Report, The New Republic, and CNN. He has written several books and produced the award-winning documentary that aired on PBS, Jihad in America. His 2002 best-selling book, American Jihad, The Terrorist Living Among Us, provides the first context and understanding for how one of the most notorious terrorist groups in the world could have plotted the worst terrorist attack on American soil without detection or scrutiny by American authorities. Once again, welcome to Take AIM. How did you come to make this study and investigation of radical Islamic terrorist groups your life's work?
Well, I was at CNN back in December of 1992, and I was sent to Oklahoma City, where I stumbled across a radical Islamic convention, unbeknownst to me and unbeknownst to CNN. And I happened to stay there for several days listening to these exhortations to commit jihad and to attack the United States, to attack our allies, picking up the worst type of inflammatory, radical, incendiary publications from organizations such as Hamas, such as Hezbollah, such as Islamic Jihad. And I discovered that this was a radical Islamic convention that had been holding yearly conferences for the previous 17 years, unbeknownst to the FBI and unbeknownst to other law enforcement. So I began investigating, and in early of 1993, as you will recall, the first World Trade Center bombing occurred that killed only, and I say only, it killed too many people, it killed seven people. But the difference between that bombing and the one that killed 3,000 was 2,994 dead. So I began looking at these Islamic groups operating on American soil that the American media was totally ignoring, and even worse than that, portraying as civil rights groups or portraying as benign organizations when in fact they had a jihadist agenda.
Well, how did CNN react? Did you try reporting about this, and were they cooperative and helpful to let you get that information out?
No, they weren't. In fact, CNN had asked me to do a special into the roots of the first World Trade Center bombing, and I came back to them with the idea of looking at how all these radical Islamic groups had morphed into legitimate, quote, legitimate organizations on American soil. So I brought the idea to them, and they did not greenlight it. In fact, they redlighted it, and so much so that the old axiom, hell has no fury, like a reporter scorned, came into being, and I quit. I actually left CNN. I took the idea to the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Richard Carlson, at that point. He liked the idea, gave me seed money, and then I ended up producing the film and reporting it for public television that aired in November of 94, and we updated it after 9/11.
Well, of course, we're about to get into discussing Nidal Hassan and what happened at Fort Hood and the various implications, but let's just do a couple of basic things first. Let's define, you mentioned jihadists that you discovered at that thing in Oklahoma City. What is jihad and people who are jihadists? What does that mean exactly?
Well, jihad can have several meanings. I mean, it can mean moral striving. And it could also mean armed struggle and to defend Islamic Holy Land or to impose Islamic sovereignty over non-Islamic lands. And that's, in fact, the definition that many Muslims in these organizations basically utilize, which is the radical militaristic definition of jihad to impose Islam on non-Muslim sovereignty, to see an Islamic caliphate, to repel non-Islamic forces, all militaristic versions that go into the definition of jihad.
And what? How about the word terrorism? What constitutes an act of terrorism, or what makes someone a terrorist?
My definition of terrorism is someone who uses military force against civilians for political purposes, and it's not a sliding scale. It's in the context of a military fight, of a military confrontation, but it would include any group, paramilitary group or you know, non-established army that definitely, definitively uses military application of force against civilians for the purposes of establishing political gains. So the classical use, of course, of the Palestinians in Munich, for example, who, you know, kidnapped the Israeli Olympic team, and then ended up shooting them in the helicopters, would be a classic definition of terrorism.
So then what happened at Fort Hood was, well, there were some civilians involved. I believe one of the 13 who was killed was civilian, but it was basically aimed at military people. Would that preclude it from being considered an act of terrorism?
Well, you raise a good question. No, because they were not there as combatants. They were there as essentially peacekeepers. They were not shot, or they were not participating in their lives as combatants. So therefore, they could not be construed as legitimate targets. So therefore, it's the same thing that happened to the U.S. Marines in 1983 in Beirut. They were military forces, of course, when they were attacked by Hezbollah, which ended up killing 241 Marines, but they were there as peacekeepers, and therefore they were not there as legitimate armed combatants. The conclusion being that the fact that they were selected meant that they were terrorist victims. The same thing happened at Fort Hood. The people there that were selected for execution, and let's be clear, they were selected for execution. He took aim at people. They were there simply in their capacity as civilians working, or even as military people working in a civilian capacity on American soil, not in any armed combating situation.
Much of the speculation has been why he did this, and the suggestions have ranged from because he was under pressure after being ordered to go to Iraq later in the month, or because he was being harassed for being Muslim, and some have even said it was PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, even though he hasn't been in a war environment. And so what do you think? Was this an act of terrorism? And if so, did any of those other factors play a role?
This was an act of terrorism. It was jihadism. He yelled at Allahu Akbar, God is greatest, when he shot people. He had communicated with Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the infamous Yemeni cleric connected to 9/11, who now spouts jihadist rhetoric. He presented a PowerPoint presentation at Walter Reed, where he justified suicide bombings. He told companions and colleagues that he believed in suicide bombings against Americans. This is a classic jihadist, and anyone who tries to ascribe it to post-traumatic stress syndrome, or simply that he snapped because of the, quote, pressures, is an apologist for radical Islam, period. I don't have any sympathy for those who make those excuses that somehow this had nothing to do with radical Islam. It had everything to do with radical Islam. Now, it doesn't mean that all members of the U.S. military are members of radical Islam, but it does mean we have a problem. If you look at previous acts of attacks on American troops in the United States, or at least attempted attacks, going back to Daniel Patrick Boyd from North Carolina, who wanted to attack the Marine base at Quantico, or the Fort Dix people who wanted to attack at Fort Dix and kill hundreds of U.S. soldiers, or the Little Rock attack that killed a Little Rock recruiter just in June by a jihadist from Yemen, an American, African-American who went there to study at the madrasa. So there is a problem that the military is not facing, and that the FBI, unfortunately, did not believe was serious enough to actually collaborate with or communicate with Army CID. I think that that's a tragedy that's going to come back to haunt them seriously.
Yes, this Anwar al-Awlaki has since praised Hassan as a hero, and it's come to light about their exchange of emails. And I got this line out of the New York Times. The federal authorities dropped an inquiry into the matter after deciding that the messages from the psychiatrist, Major Hassan, did not suggest any threat of violence, and concluding that no further action was warranted.
I'm actually stunned, Roger, at that comment, that one could communicate with a figure, a radical figure such as Anwar al-Awlaki, who was connected to 9/11, who has supported suicide bombings against Americans, who has supported the 9/11 attacks. That's like saying one could communicate with a Hitler on a benign basis and not be worried about the fact that there was communication between a Hitler type and a U.S. soldier. It's absurd. So somebody's political correctness trumped reason in that decision.
Yes, you point out that he was, Awlaki was linked to 9/11. His name appeared in the 9/11 commission report. Tell us how he was linked to 9/11.
He was the imam in San Diego when two of the 9/11 hijackers from Saudi Arabia became his acolytes and followed him when he moved from San Diego to Dar al-Hijra, which is in Falls Church, Virginia, and became the imam of the mosque at Dar al-Hijra. He definitely was connected to two of the 9/11 hijackers and may have been their inspiration for giving them motivation and for continuing to spur them on. We don't know exactly what happened because he ultimately disappeared from the United States, even though he has American citizenship. He himself is a radical Yemen ancestry, and he definitely was connected to 9/11 in terms of the overall plot.
President Obama said we shouldn't jump to any conclusions, yet within a day, the FBI was putting out statements saying there was no evidence indicating that this was an act of terrorism or that he was linked to anyone else. Isn't that a bit of a contradiction?
That's a total contradiction, and one that doesn't befit the FBI, because the FBI, generally speaking, does not engage in political rhetoric. It calls the shots as they are. And I work with FBI agents all the time. And I must tell you, there are FBI agents who are furious with the comments made that this was not an act of terrorism. It reminds me of what happened after the shooting at LAX by a guy named Mohammed Hadayat, who killed two American Israelis at LAX in, I believe it was July of 2002, when the head of the FBI in L.A. said that wasn't an act of terrorism. 9 months later, he came to eat his words when he finally said, yes, it was an act of terrorism. An act of terrorism doesn't require a conspiracy. It requires simply one person to carry out an act of violence against civilians for political purposes. And it's exactly the type of behavior in which Malik Hassan engaged in.
Well, it seems like there is a huge disconnect between what President Obama is saying about this and what seems like a majority of Americans believe, that as you say, that this was an act of terrorism. That would seem to possibly be damaging to President Obama's credibility on this issue, and he seems willing to risk that.
Yes, he does seem willing to risk it, and that's to his own, if he wants to do that, that's fine, but the American public should be under no illusion. President Obama is misleading the American public in saying that we don't know his motivation or that this was not an act of terrorism. That's a definite, what can I say? It's definitely misleading. It's worse than that. It's propaganda, and it's propaganda for political purposes. And the president owes it to the American public to be truthful, to be candid, to be honest, and to tell the American public that this was an act of terrorism committed by a committed jihadist against innocent U.S. Personnel on a military base, and that we need to confront. Listen, if we can't even utter the term radical Islam, and the president has yet to use that term, he has never used the term radical Islam or Islamic militant or Islamic jihad in terms of describing the types of forces that we are faced with around the world. If he can't use that term, and we don't want to use the term, then how can we ever defeat our enemy?
Yeah, are you suggesting that the FBI making such statements, that they were told to or asked to do this and did it for that reason, or do you think this came from internal actions?
You know, I don't know, Roger, where that came from, but be honest with you, I can tell you that FBI agents on the ground, the grunts that I deal with, were not happy at all with that. They were furious with that statement. They know exactly that this was an act of terrorism. And I can tell you personally that agents on the ground are pursuing this as an act of terrorism in terms of their forensic investigation. So the question is, was the head of the FBI told to issue the statement or not? I don't know the answer to that question, but whatever the case is, the head of the FBI or the public director of the FBI should not be issuing directives and statements that are contrary to the public truth. And the public truth states is clearly obvious here that Major Malik Hassan was a jihadist. One doesn't yell out, Allahu Akbar, God is greatest. It's not God is great, but God is greatest, EST, and start shooting as many military civilians as possible unless one is a committed jihadist.
So one question that comes to mind is, are there others in our military who have been, say, communicating with Al-Laki or going visiting other sort of radical Islamic websites? And are these same investigators who were aware of Hassan, are they aware of them? And then the question becomes, what do they do about it? Is it conceivable that we might start scrutinizing the communications that Muslims in the military are engaged in, and if found to be active on these sites, then possibly to remove them from the military now, or is nothing going to change?
Well, then you raise a very good question, Roger. I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but to tell you the truth, if a member of the military is communicating with a known terrorist overseas, I don't care what political persuasion that terrorist is, that member of the military needs to be expelled immediately. Do you remember when, several years ago, it was discovered there was a Ku Klux Klan cell at Fort Bragg, and the military jumped down that cell and rooted out anybody connected to the Ku Klux Klan within a matter of months? I mean, they really pursued that one with a vengeance. That same type of vengeance against radicalism needs to be pursued against jihadists in the military. And maybe there aren't any others. It's possible there aren't any others. That's fine. But to assume that without on the basis without any investigation is simply it's not factual and without substance. You've got to assume that there are others who've been in touch. Look, the fact of the matter is Major Hassan believed that the war against Islam was a war. The war against terrorism was a war against Islam. Now that message is an incendiary message that motivates jihadists to carry out attacks. Okay, that's the same type of message that motivated the 9/11 hijackers. And by the way, it's the same type of message, Roger, that the Council on American Islamic Relations CARE constantly puts out in its conferences and its rallies and its gatherings and its dinners that it has around the country. It constantly puts out the referential equation that the war on terror is a war against Islam. Nothing could be more incendiary than that type of a statement. And that statement was definitely utilized by Major Hassan in his calculations before he decided to carry out his murderous rampage at Fort Hood.
Now, Senator Lieberman has announced plans to hold hearings. I'm thinking with his comments about joining with the Republicans to filibuster a public option, and now this, the Democrats might be regretting that they ever brought him into their conference, but do you think that these hearings will actually happen? And if so, will the people who have investigated Hassan and his connections with Al-Laki and others, will they cooperate? And will the Obama administration cooperate? What do you know about these hearings, A, if they're going to be held, and B, what we might expect from them?
We were in touch initially with his office, but I don't know whether they will be held or not. I'm presuming they will be held, and I'm presuming that he's going to get people to testify. Again, the political correctness factor is the one you raise, and whether, in fact, officials from the Obama administration are going to present one of these, poker faces and claim that somehow this had nothing to do with terrorism. And I can't predict that. So far, the Obama administration's response has been thoroughly not full of candor and full of deception. And whether they continue to perpetrate that deception is anyone's guess.
Let's touch on a few other things in our remaining minutes. You brought up the group CARE, and I know you sort of had a long-running battle, and they come after you. But you point out, and you have in your book and your documentary, Jihad in America, about these sort of radical Islamic front groups in America and how they operate here. And tell us, just give us a little summary of where that stands today. What to what extent is this growing? Does it exist? What should we be aware of about them?
Well, CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, was deemed to be a Hamas front by the FBI in the 2008 trial of the Hamas leaders in Texas. And after that trial, the FBI severed its relations with CARE because of its ties to Hamas. And you have to remember that in the United States, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the group that was founded in Egypt in the 1920s and then expanded throughout the Middle East and then Europe and then the United States in the 60s and 70s, dominates and is the center of political and religious gravity for many of these organizations that now exist here: the Islamic Society of North America, the Islamic Circle of North America, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Muslim Public Affairs Council. All of those groups are connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, either being derivative or somehow affiliated with. And they constitute the center of political religious gravity, and they pretend to be civil rights groups. They pretend to be civilian groups that are concerned with the civil rights of Americans. But in fact, their primary preoccupation is civil rights for terrorists. And they issue incendiary statements, and they're always trying to apologize for radical Islam. So I think American public should definitely be aware of the fact that these groups are involved in major deception. I call it the grand deception, where they try to convince the American public that they're innocent, like the Rotary Club, when in fact they're much more like the Ku Klux Klan.
Now, on your website, and I want you to tell people what your website is so they can come to it, but you have a piece about some disturbing things that you found at our State Department and on websites linked to our State Department. Tell us first your website and then tell us about that.
The website address is it's called the www.investigativeproject.org. Again, www.investigativeproject.org. One word, except for .org, and because it's the Investigative Project on Terrorism. And on the website, we have an investigation done into one of the websites operated by the State Department, in which it is which we found to be a full-fledged propaganda arm of jihadists or of Islamists in terms of promoting radical views held by the Council on American Islamic Relations, held by fanatical Muslims. I mean, it's disgraceful and a major expenditure of wasteful expenditure of U.S. funds for us to be propagating views for radical jihadists on American websites. And I encourage everyone to go there and then contact the State Department and contact their congressmen, senators and House of Representatives, members of Congress, to protest the fact that U.S. funds, State Department funds, are being expended for this purpose.
So what can people do to reverse this, such as what you're just talking about at the State Department and sort of the tolerance for these front groups that are operating in this country? I mean, what do you urge people to do, and what would you like to see done in Congress or through law enforcement and just by grassroots people?
Well, I tell you, Roger, I think political correctness is our death knell, and I think that political correctness has now governed the policies of this administration regarding radical Islam, and it governs the policies of the State Department. So I'd like to see some accountability. I mean, when we pay our taxes, we shouldn't be paying taxes for websites that promote jihad or that promote the Council on American Islamic Relations. I mean, that's absurd. We shouldn't be paying a penny of our hard-earned money to go to pay for these types of expenditures. So I would like to see people write to their congressmen. There are certain leaders in Congress who have been phenomenal, Senator Sue Myrick from North Carolina, Congressman Frank Wolf from Northern Virginia, Congressman Pete Hoekstra from Michigan, Senator Kyle from Arizona. Those are congressmen, among others. I don't mean to single them out only, but there are others as well who have been exemplary in terms of their dedication to rooting out this jihadist expenditures on funding and the political correctness that governs that decision.
And we're going to have to wrap it up. One more question here. How would you rate how the media have covered this last week since this Fort Hood event, and sort of give us your media watchdog analysis of the media? You know, how they've covered this last week.
Well, MSNBC has been the worst, followed by CNN. Even though the evidence portrayed coming out of the Washington Post has been overwhelming, the fact remains that Chris Matthews, Evan Thomas, and other pundits have been trying to portray this as simply an act of post-traumatic stress syndrome, or is that somebody who snapped without any political or religious agenda. Nothing could be further from the truth. So the political correctness of the mainstream media has been atrocious, Roger. But I think the American public gets it. I think they really do. I think they understand exactly what was going on here. And despite the efforts by MSNBC or those on CNN to portray this simply as an act of innocent road rage, I think those efforts will fail.
And one last time, your website again?
It's www.investigativeproject.org.
It's been Steve Emerson, the Executive Director of the Investigative Project on Terrorism. Thank you so much for being with us, Steve.
You're very welcome.
And now we're going to get right into our next interview. I'm going to turn over the mic to Don Irvine, the chairman of Accuracy in Media, and my co-host on Take Aim. Don, take it away.
All right. Thanks, Roger. Lee, are you there?
Yes, I am, Don.
Okay, great. First, let me introduce you to our audience. Lee Edwards is widely regarded as the chief historian of the American conservative movement. He has published more than 15 books about the leading individuals and institutions of American conservatism, including biographies of Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater, and a history of the Heritage Foundation. He is Heritage's Distinguished Fellow in Conservative Thought and serves as an adjunct professor of politics at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C. Edwards was also the founding director of the Institute on Political Journalism at Georgetown University, and a fellow at the Institute of Politics at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He is a past president of the Philadelphia Society and has been a media fellow at the Hoover Institution. But the main reason we're having Mr. Edwards on to be our guest today on Take Aim is his role as chairman as the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, which reached an important goal in 2007, the creation of an international memorial in Washington to the more than 100 million victims of communism. It was also for this work that we gave Lee the Reed Irvine Accuracy and Media Award in 2008.
And it's one of the most honored awards I've ever gotten, Don. And thank you once again for so recognizing our work.
Well, you're so kind to say that. Let me start off first by just, since we're talking about this memorial, you know, what was the inspiration for this? How did this all come about?
Well, as a matter of fact, Don, it is because of the fall of the Berlin Wall 20 years ago. My wife and I and some other people were sitting around one Sunday, just a couple of months after the wall came down in 1989, November of 1989, and we said that already we could feel that people were beginning to say, oh, well, now it's over, we don't have to worry about communism anymore, or why we fought the Cold War, let's move on. And we decided what we had to do was to memorialize the victims and to keep reminding people about the crimes of communism. And we came up with the idea of a memorial in Washington, D.C., to the victims of communism. It took us a few years. That was in 1990. The memorial went up in 2007. So about 17 years of work and raising funds, selecting a site, coming up with the right design and so forth. But it's there, and it's a remarkable thing, Don, but it is still the world's only memorial to all the victims of communism. I mean, there are national memorials in various countries that did suffer under communism, particularly in Eastern Europe. But this is the first and still the only one memorial to all the victims.
Did you find that it was particularly difficult to go through that process of trying to get this memorial going? I know that President Clinton, I guess, signed the legislation.
Yes, he did, as a matter of fact. There was a Democratic Congress which approved the law. You must have a law. Don, it's an incredible, and I'm all for the process. There are 24 steps, as a matter of fact, which you must negotiate to get a memorial or a monument in Washington, D.C., and that's to really test you and see if you're serious about this. So to do all of that, first to get Congress to pass a law, then to put together the right kind of organization, then to get a site, and then to get the design approved by various governmental commissions, and finally to raise the money. So, yes, it's a challenge.
Now, recently I've seen that you have now launched the Global Museum on Communism.
Right.
I can tell is the first online museum that I know of. What's going on with that?
Well, after we finished up the memorial, and even before that we had dedicated the memorial, and by the way, President Bush was there and gave a very strong anti-communist speech, and for that he deserves to be commended. But even before we put up the memorial, we realized we just couldn't stop there, that particularly we had to go about educating people, and young people especially, about communism, what it was and what it still is in places like Cuba and China, North Korea, and also to explain to them why we fought the Cold War. And so that is why we began working on an online museum, which we call the Global Museum on Communism.org. And I'm happy to say we launched it in June of this year, Don. And already we have had over 50,000 visitors. These are not just hits, but these are people who come and stay for 3 and 4 and 5 minutes going through our museum, which I'm very proud of. We're very proud of.
So how has this been received otherwise? I mean, you're talking about how we need to educate, say, the young people of today about this. Are you saying that there's a general perception, though, that maybe the education community is not teaching our kids in schools about the evils, the dangers of communism that's still out there?
Well, I think what's happened is that there is some very pro forma discussion and some very technical and very academic. I mean, I have here in front of me the textbook which you use in Virginia high schools, for example. And it's actually not bad when it comes to talking about the Cold War. Does talk about those who suffered behind the Iron Curtain. It even quotes Ronald Reagan saying that communism was destined for the ash heap of history. But when it starts talking about communism as such, as an ism, then it gets, I think, does not go far enough. For example, it talks about it strictly being a social system or an economic system. It does not get into the politics, and there's no mention, for example, of the Gulag, the system of forced labor camps in the Soviet Union, and through which some 20 million people passed over the decades, and about half of whom we think, and we estimate, died. No mention of the Laogai, which is the Chinese version of this. No mention of purges or forced famine, but the people of, for example, Ukraine died up to 5, 6, 7 million. So it's this human side, the political side, the communism, which is not discussed in this history book, and that's where we come in with our Global Museum on Communism, because we do it, I think, in a very dramatic and effective way.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning about how the genesis, or part of the genesis of this idea, was the fall of the Berlin Wall. Obviously, this has been a very historic week. On Monday, to be exact, that was the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Symbolically, it's treated as the day that the Soviet Union ended its grip on Eastern Europe and ultimately began the collapse of the 70-year-old Soviet Empire. What's your perspective on this, on the significance of this date?
Well, I think, Don, if you think back and if you're of a certain age, you remember those wonderful pictures from Berlin on that evening of November 9th, 1989, when people were literally dancing and cheering and singing and toasting each other with champagne and other liquids on top of the Berlin Wall. And they were celebrating, of course, the end of over 40 years of tyranny. For 40 years, the people of Germany, East Germany, and also Czechoslovakia, Poland, and all the other countries of Eastern Europe had labored and had been under communism, and not by their choice. So perhaps 100 million people really were celebrating that night. But also we have to keep in mind that this was the effective end of the Cold War, and therefore this is where the United States should also be celebrating this date, because we fought a hard, long, well, the most protracted conflict in U.S. history was the Cold War. We have to remember that some 90,000 Americans died in both the Korean and the Vietnam War, as well as many, many others, hundreds and perhaps even thousands who died. We don't really know all of the names. For example, people who were involved in trying to combat the KGB behind the Iron Curtain. Those who were shot down, for example, in the DMZ in Korea, those who were killed along the Berlin Wall, and there were people like that. Major Nicholson, a very famous and infamous case, who was murdered by a German policeman, a German soldier and sentry, with no reason whatsoever in the mid-1980s. So all of these things, all of these facts, it seems to us, have to be remembered, celebrated, solemnly acknowledged, so that we don't have this kind of tyranny come back ever again.
I was noticing in the news coverage, and I saw something, I think it was on ABC, maybe the World News Program, now that the wall is gone and they were looking at the celebration and everything like this anniversary, there's basically, I guess, kind of a strip of bricks or something like that that kind of runs through where the East and West actually have the wall. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem that a lot of people know that, you know, even underfoot sometimes that there was this monumental wall, this thing that really divided the two countries. In looking at and Reagan's role in this too, it seems that in the media we're not seeing a lot of credit to him. I noticed through my friends that there was a lot of postings of the video of Reagan's speech at Brandenburg. But I don't see a lot of that follow through in the media. They seem to want to downplay Reagan's role in this. As someone who's looked at Reagan's history, what do you think about this?
Well, Don, you're absolutely right, and it is to me almost a shocking thing that they do use that one film clip, and when President Reagan, that was in June of 1987, said, Mr. Gorbachev. Open up this gate, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And they like that. And, of course, it's a very dramatic moment. But that is not as far. It's just sort of the tip of the iceberg of the Reagan Doctrine, which he implemented right away. As a matter of fact, the story is told, and it is an accurate story, that in early as 1977, which was 4 years before he became president, he was meeting with a foreign policy advisor, a gentleman named Richard Allen, who actually became his first national security advisor when he was president. And they were talking about foreign policy. They were talking about the Cold War. And Mr. Reagan said, I do have what some people may call a simplistic idea, but I just think it's a simple way of ending the Cold War. And it's this: we win and they lose. And, Don, it's a remarkable thing, but no president had ever said that before, that to stake out a policy of victory, to end the Cold War in victory and not in a tie, which is what detente and the combination had been doing for too long. And then Reagan went on as president to implement the Reagan Doctrine, which is a very sophisticated, multifaceted program. It was strategic, building up our military. It was economic. We were deliberately preventing technology being able to be sold to the Soviet Union. We blocked that over and over again, blocking their attempt to sell their natural gas and oil. So all of these things, taken with also a public diplomacy initiative and helping people like Solidarity in Poland, this very sophisticated doctrine put such pressure on the Soviet Union that what seemed impossible did happen, and that was a peaceful end to the Cold War. Effectively, without a shot being fired.
Yeah, so do you see that as a victory for the West and Western values and ideals?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Don. And you've hit upon the key point, and that is that Reagan himself said in his autobiography afterwards that it really was a battle not just between two nations or even between two forces, you know, the Warsaw Pact and the U.S. and its allies, but it was a battle of ideas. And one idea was freedom, liberty, democratic institutions, and the other was tyranny, was totalitarianism, was the party telling everybody what they had to do, and freedom triumphed. And that is a great, great story. So I wish that were more the story which was being told by our mass media. Of course, our conservative media, I'm happy to say, are doing a good job about it, Don. But as you know only too well, the mainstream media or the drive-by media, whatever you want to call it, when they're confronted with something like this, they just turn away.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me. I mean, one of the headlines or at least storylines I saw when I was looking at the paper the other day was just how everybody is, you know, yelling out and thanking Gorby, you know, Mr. Gorbachev for this event.
Yes,
and that just seems to be extremely wrong in my view.
Well, Gorbachev did make a contribution to the end of the Cold War, and that was he finally abandoned the Brezhnev Doctrine, which said that the Soviet Union would use force if necessary to ensure that a socialist state remained a socialist state. So throughout 1989, when first Poland, then Hungary, then Czechoslovakia, and all of these countries began electing people and electing non-communists and anti-communists like Lech Walesa and Václav Havel, Mr. Gorbachev did not send in the Soviet troops and prevent that from happening. But the question is, why did he abandon the Brezhnev Doctrine? He abandoned it, A, because the Soviet Union was bankrupt and no longer had the military which it had had before, and B, he desperately needed to make friends with the West to try to prop up this disintegrating Soviet empire. So it was a gamble on his part. It didn't pay off because he unleashed the genie of freedom and liberty, and which brought down the Soviet Union, the dissolution of the Soviet Union itself in December of 91, some 2 years after the Berlin Wall came down.
Now, an article I read by Peter Beinart for the Daily Beast suggested that conservatives have Reagan's role all wrong. He argues that Reagan was hawkish and belligerent and calling Soviets the evil empire in his first term, and then in his second term he turns around and he was almost naively dovish, eager to make a nuclear arms reduction agreement that many conservatives
view
as dangerous and foolish.
That's such a total, not just a misreading of history, but it's a deliberate distortion of the facts. And as I said, Reagan said, even before he became president, you know, we win and they lose. He said, how are we going to achieve that? We're going to do it by building up the military, which we had let decline all during the 1970s and even the 1960s after the Vietnam War. Once we had built up and we could deal from strength, then he said, I am willing to sit down and talk to the Soviets. But the Soviets, particularly after we built up the military, particularly after Mr. Reagan initiated the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, realized they couldn't win any kind of arms race. They had not the technology, didn't have the resources, didn't have the science, couldn't possibly match us. So they began suing for peace. They wouldn't have done so without the military buildup, without SDI, without Ronald Reagan saying, look, we're going to end this, but we're going to end it in a victory for freedom, not a victory for the forces of tyranny and totalitarianism.
Now, I think you probably would agree that there's more than one person that would probably deserve some credit for the collapse of the Soviet Union. If you could take a score of 100 or whatever, how would you apportion that to, say, credit to Reagan, Thatcher, Gorbachev, Walesa?
Right. Well, that of course, this was an epic event, and Václav Havel himself said this was an event, the collapse of the Soviet Empire, was an event on the same sort of scale of historical importance as the collapse of the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago. So there obviously were a lot of factors. You had those wonderful, courageous dissident leaders like Havel, like Walesa, and others in Eastern and Central Europe. you did have Margaret Thatcher, who was such a stalwart ally of what we were trying to do here in terms of a military buildup and taking a strong stand against the Soviets. You had an admission, a realist, if you will, in Mikhail Gorbachev, but we also have to keep in mind with regard to Gorbachev and things like Glasnost and Perestroika, what was he trying to do? He was trying to save the socialist system, the communist system. He was not a liberal Democrat, and we've got to get that straight. He was not a liberal Democrat. He was a Leninist. He was still trying to maintain power in the Communist Party and in himself, unelected leader of the Soviet Union. And then you do have someone like Ronald Reagan. So I think on that 100% thing, I mean, I wouldn't give Reagan, 70 or 80 or what have you, but I certainly would say that the things that all of these things are interconnected with the leadership she provided. So I think it's probably fair to give him 50%. Maybe I'm a little biased and prejudiced. Let's say 48% out of 100% to Ronald Reagan. His leadership was decisive. It was creative. It was comprehensive. It was historic.
So how is it that an ideology that was responsible for the deaths of more than 100 million people is still romanticized by whether it's expressed in Che Guevara T-shirts or admiration for Castro, Mao, Hugo Chavez, et cetera?
Right. That's a wonderful question, Don. And it's one that we've wrestled with and tried to answer many times. I think probably this, that there is a utopian element of communism which can appeal to the romantic, to the idealistic, to the naive, and to the utopian, who somehow thinks that it's possible to bring about this world in which we're going to put aside things like private property and individualism, all for the better good, all for the group, all for the community, all for the nation. Well, first of all, it's totally utopian. Anytime communism has been tried, and has been tried, it has always resulted in the dictatorship of the party, has resulted in purges and famines and show trials, gulags, prisons, and murder after murder. And secondly, it is, I think, contra to human nature. I mean, human nature is based upon the idea of the individual. It's based upon the idea of having, something you can call your own. Maybe it's a house, maybe it's a little farm, maybe it's a little business, and being able to achieve your goal through your own efforts and your own abilities. All of that is denied under communism. But still, on the other hand, it is appealing to some people who think this idea of creating a perfect world here, as a conservative and as a small-d Democrat, I would say that's just not possible.
So let me ask you about your thoughts about Hugo Chavez and what's going on in Venezuela. I mean, how do you see him and what he has done to that country?
Right. Well, I think, Don, he's no question he's a socialist. There's no question that he has close ties to Fidel Castro. We know that, and that's been publicly not only Fidel but Raul and then the whole Cuban communist government. So, and we know that he's reaching out and trying to create a sort of a new Marxist empire in Latin America, and that's a great danger. And I wish that our government was paying more attention to it. I wish that our Secretary of State were paying more attention to it, because this has great danger for us. This is maybe a small cloud right now, but it could be a very large one and could loom over all of Latin America. So we really need to pay more attention to that, counter that with public diplomacy, counter it with political measures, counter it by supporting dissidents within Venezuela. I mean, there are ways of doing this without talking about sending in, half a million troops. That's always a measure of last resort. So I'm concerned, deeply concerned, about what's going on in Venezuela.
How much responsibility do the media and Hollywood have for the fact that communism is not viewed as being just as evil as the Nazis?
Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating to me. The Holocaust, what happened to the Jews of Europe, is is an incredible story. It's a tragic story. It's one of the great crimes of the 20th century. And Hollywood has pictured it over and over again. Television has and so forth. It's a part of our culture. But when you get to communism and the fact that Lenin and Stalin and Mao were even greater monsters than Adolf Hitler in terms of numbers of people who died under communism as opposed to Nazism, this is a story which needs to be told, can be told, should be told. And so the failure to do so is, again, this idea that there are certain utopians who think that, well, you know, communism, socialism, it really has good motives in mind, but that has not been the end result when it has been tried and attempted. So I think Hollywood has a lot to answer for. And I will say this, though, Don, that we do know that there is a growing conservative community in Hollywood, and I think there'll be more films, both in Hollywood feature films as well as on television, about communism. I do begin to feel and sense a shift on this.
So I think we need to kind of wrap this all up, but let me ask you a couple more quick questions.
Surely.
You know, with regard to where we are today, what do you think that Ronald Reagan would think of, you know, our in terms of our federal government expansion, you know, the reach, you know, with all these things that have been going on lately?
Well, I think he'd be appalled, Don, by what's going on. After all, he came to office saying that, you know, we need to limit government, not to expand it. And he did say that in this crisis, government is not the solution. Government is the problem. So I think that he would gather up all the strength and all the eloquence that he had at his command and would say there's a better way to do this than to constantly look to Washington and the federal government to solve our problems.
And talking about even politics today, where there's a lot of schism or division between the conservatives and Republican Party, as somebody who's really been a great historian about this.
Right.
How do you see all this playing out?
I think that what happened was that the Republican Party in 2006 and 2008 did not run on conservative principles, but ran away from conservative principles and ideas. And they paid a price for it, which is to say resounding defeat. So there's a now reassessment going on. There's sort of a, where do we go from here? What do we do? How do we get ourselves together? And I think the answer is to look back to the Reagan example, which was he was a master fusionist. He was able to reach out and bring together social conservatives, economic conservatives, national conservatives, national security conservatives. And I think that's what needs to be done right now. I mean, the idea of sort of trying to throw overboard someone like Sarah Palin because she's a social conservative is just, you know, crazy. I mean, politics is addition, not subtraction. So I wish people would talk more about bringing people together, finding that let's find a common ground of opposing this Leviathan government that we have right now, realize that we do have a foreign enemy in terrorism, and let's work together to defeat those enemies, both here at home and abroad.
Well, great, Lee. We're just about out of time. If you want to just give us your website one more time.
Yes, it'd be my pleasure, Don. Thank you so much. It's globalmuseumoncommunism.org. That's all one word, globalmuseumoncommunism.org. Please join our visitors. I think that you'll be impressed by it, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Great, Lee. Thanks again for your time today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Don. Keep up the marvelous work, the important work, which Accuracy in Media is doing.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Don, that was a great interview, very enlightening, and I hope our listeners will go out and do some research on their own and look into this with there's a lot going on. This was Veterans Day this week, and with this 20th anniversary, and then with what Steve Emerson was talking about in the first part, we have a lot to reflect on, a lot to think about, and our show, Take Aim, is doing a lot to bring a lot of these ideas forth. So anyway, look, folks, this has been a powerful show. I hope you'll send the link of this show to your friends, and when you do, go on our website, take a look at some of the other shows we've done recently. There's a lot of great stuff there. And just sign up on our website to receive the daily emails. We've got a lot of good stuff, a lot of video that nobody else is covering. We send our American Journalism Center interns around town. And again, I want to thank our great producer, Sarah Norton, and we will be back next week for another episode of Take Aim.